Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the July issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Many thrills, one vacation. Whatever your adventure pleasure, Colorado delivers. Story and photos by Matt Crossman. Gripping a sliver of granite, I pulled myself up to the right of a chin of rock jutting out from Boulder Canyon, 30 feet off the ground. I plastered myself to the rock face, unclipped the carabiner, swung my left foot around the chin, and planted it. On what, frankly, I have no idea, but I put weight on it, and it held. I bear-hugged the rock as I swung my body over. Next thing I knew, my chin was pressed against the rock chin as I plotted my next move. The fact that in a couple of hours of climbing I was already comfortable enough to do that was a testament to my teachers, Mo Beck, one of the National Geographic's 2019 Adventurers of the Year, and her climbing partner, Justin Berger. I looked up. I had maybe 30 more feet to go on this pitch called Lightning Strike in an area known as Cascade Crag, just outside Boulder, Colorado. An hour earlier, I would have seen nothing but flat rock and said, "No way can I climb that." But having already completed three pitches and watching Beck and Berger do the same, I saw a path. Each step along the way shone as if lit by neon arrows. Right hand here, left hand there, right foot stretch over to that knob, etc. A few minutes later, I slapped the top. I caught my breath for a minute up there, and as I rappelled down, I paused again. To my right and left, climbers worked their way up and down the rock face. As I floated there, I had a curious thought. I wonder what my wife and two daughters are doing right this second. I've taken many people on assignment with me, my brother, a bunch of friends, my wife, one kid at a time, both of my girls, 13 and 10, together. But I've never taken our whole family of four until now in a week-long trip to Colorado that I called He Thrills, They Chill. Today, thrilling meant rock climbing in Boulder for me, and chilling meant jam making at Three Leaf Farm in Lafayette for them. I was definitely thrilling with Beck and Berger. Were they chilling with Three Leaf Farm co-owner Sarah Martinelli? I hoped so. An hour later, Beck, Berger, and I arrived in downtown Boulder for lunch. As we walked to a Mexican restaurant, just by coincidence, so did my wife and kids. "Hey," I hollered as they approached. I was still high on adrenaline and eager to tell them all about my adventure. Before I could say a word, my daughters launched into a description of theirs. "We made jam and saw animals and patted dogs and held ducks and goats, and the puppy was so cute I wanted to steal it." They took a breath, so I jumped in and said, "I climbed four pitches. Three of them were really steep, and I didn't fall or die or anything." Then we went inside and had an outstanding lunch. Also, the strawberry and lemon jam they made at Three Leaf Farms was delicious. I had an ulterior motive for calling this trip He Thrills, They Chill. I wanted my girls to see the thrills and yearn for some of their own. Nothing crazy, of course. I merely hoped that at some point they would walk right up to the edge of their comfort zones, get a little scared and maybe even a lot scared, and then take one more step. And for that we were in the right place. Whatever their comfort level for adventure, whatever anybody's comfort level, Colorado has something for it. I learned that more than anywhere else in Estes Park, where my wife and the girls chilled at YMCA of the Rockies. There they met Wade Jagrian for a morning event called Creek Stompin'. Their task was to determine the presence, if any, of pollution. They walked together to a creek where a duck watched as they gathered samples of water. They tested the water for acid first, and the results were good. As they waited for results from an oxygen test, they lifted rocks and scraped the macroinvertebrates off of them and into the sections of an ice cube tray. Jagim pulled out an identification chart which listed pictures of bugs and categorized them according to their pollution tolerance. In one of the trays, they found a nymph that is intolerant to pollution. So between that and the two other tests, they concluded the creek was healthy. As they chilled studying small things, I thrilled studying a big thing, Twin Sisters Mountain. For hours, my face was right up against it, thanks to Kent Mountain Adventure Center. Co-owner Dustin Dyer, an experienced climber, traveler, and mountain biker, says the company's operating principle is to ask themselves, what would I want to do on vacation? And then craft experiences accordingly. In this case, the answer, tackle an impossible route up a mountain, required building a via ferrata. Translated from Italian as iron path, a via ferrata is a climbing route fitted with a series of steel cables and hand and footholds that turn ascending a mountain into a cross between hiking and rock climbing. Though via ferrata date to the 18th century, people tend to associate them with World War I, when Italian soldiers built them so they could get across the mountains rather than going around. They've been popular in Europe for decades, and in the last few years they've caught on in the United States. As we climbed 600 vertical feet to the top of DeVille Rocks, Dyer told stories of chasing adventure all over the world. He had been struck by lightning twice and caught in avalanches twice. After an avalanche killed his best friend, Rick Gockel, Dyer thought his life needed more chilling and less thrilling. At the funeral, he told Gockel's mom that. She said, "You can make a good decision. You can mitigate the risk, but you can't stay home." So he hasn't. As we talked down the mountain, we talked up about the life-enriching difference between mitigating risk and completely avoiding it. It was time to introduce my girls to that idea. If it's active and ends in ing, you can do it in Grand County. Located 67 miles from Denver by the calculations of visitgrandcounty.com, Grand County covers 1,870 square miles and has just over 15,000 full-time residents, all of whom appeared to have gathered at Lake Grand Lake on a glorious Friday morning. The lake teemed with kayaks, canoes, jet skis, pontoon boats, speed boats, paddle boards, swimmers, and more. The four of us rented two tandem kayaks from mountain paddlers. With life jackets buckled snugly across our chests, we pushed off into the water, and I thought back to the first and only other time my wife and I rented a tandem kayak. "I call them divorce boats," said the man we rented them from in Bermuda. We laughed at that, and an hour later, as I paddled, I wondered when Emily was going to steer us away from shore. At that exact moment, she wondered when I was going to stop paddling so we wouldn't hit shore. When we hit it, we both asked the other what had just happened. There were no such miscommunications on Grand Lake, which is surprising considering the distractions. Everywhere we looked, beauty. It was like kayaking at the bottom of a striped bowl. Thick evergreens formed on the top stripe. Below that stood a ring of cabins, one of which was ours at Grand Lake Lodge, which celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2020. Along the shore were vacation homes I couldn't pay off in five lifetimes. My older daughter and I weaved our way across the lake, stopping only to exult in the view and allow powerboats to pass. My wife and our younger daughter followed behind us, though eventually we lost them on the crowded lake. We found them on shore an hour later and explored downtown Grand Lake together. If nothing else, the girls were learning to chase culinary adventure. At lunch at Sagebrush Barbecue and Grill, we split a plate of Rocky Mountain oysters. We woke up the next morning in an Airstream at River Run RV Park in Granby, and I flashed back to my childhood trailer camping in Michigan. We never had an Airstream, but I remember my dad admiring them, and he reiterated his fondness when I told him we'd be staying in one. As the sun cooked off the morning mist, I plopped two stand-up paddleboards into the pond at the center of the resort, attached the straps to the girls' ankles, pushed them toward the center of the water, and wondered what would happen next. I stayed on shore because, A, based on my previous experience on stand-up paddleboards, I knew I would fall, and often, and B, the water was too cold for that, for me at least. They are old enough to decide if it's too cold to go swimming, and they've never heard of such a thing. They floated around for a few minutes, getting used to the boards and trying to screw up the courage to stand up. I moved up and down the shore, trying to figure out which mountain to get in the background of the pictures I would take of them. I snapped out of my mountain photo reverie when one of them, then the other, called to me. "Should I try it?" they asked. "Of course," I said, simultaneously hoping and doubting that they would. Soon they were both standing and paddling. They never fell, the little show-offs. A sure sign that a day is going to be good is if I have to sign a waiver. It was way harder to sign waivers for my girls. But I scribbled my name at the Fraser Valley Sport Complex, about 5 minutes from the town of Winter Park, for an aerial excursion with Winter Park Adventure Quest, and hoped for the best. The rope's course apparatus looked like a jungle gym, as imagined by the set designer for Lord of the Rings. Wires and rope bridges and planks ringed the two-story structure. My hands clammy, I sipped water, as I always do when I'm nervous. As I tightened the older one's harness, my hand slipped, and I bashed her in the face. For a second, I thought I broke her glasses. Better safe than sorry. A mom and three boys joined us as we tackled a variety of obstacles to get around the rope's course. And by we tackled, I mean they tackled. I am, I discovered, terrible at rope's course. I mostly watched. Imagine two wooden swings adjacent to each other, each 3 inches wide and 8 feet long, and you have to shimmy sideways across them while suspended 15 feet above the ground. You're buckled up by carabiners, of course, but the only thing you have to hold on to is a rope hanging in the center of each one. I made it halfway across before realizing I had no idea what I was doing. I shuffled back from whence I had come. My younger daughter started, stopped, got scared, took one more step, then another, and soon enough completed the whole thing. A few minutes later, the older one froze at the start of an obstacle. Imagine still being 15 feet up, and now you're facing a series of ropes shaped like giant U's hanging overhead. To get across, you step from one to the next. That was a big hill to the no for me. She stood on one end of the obstacle. I stood on the other. She asked me how to do it. I offered my best guess, but did not try myself. The very definition is, do as I say, not as I do. For a minute, two, three, she couldn't move. She wanted to give up. I thought she was going to, but she didn't. After instruction from the guide, she not only tried, she finished. Then she climbed down off the rope's course and scaled the adjacent rock wall before I could even get down to watch her. Full to bursting with pride, not lunch, naturally, I wanted to take my helmet off and spike it like a football. But the girls hate it when I overreact, which I never do, so I played it cool. I just stood there on the ropes course platform, chilling.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from True West Magazine, June 1959 edition. A noted Texas writer investigates to see why there was no help for the Alamo. By J. Frank Dobie. Author's note. Although Texas Independence Day, March 2nd, and San Jacinto Day, April 21st, are legal holidays in Texas, the battle ending in the fall of the Alamo, without a single fighting Texan left alive, arouses more imagination than the 2 days combined that we Texans celebrate. The main facts about the battle are popularly known. A slight knowledge of these facts overwhelmed me with awe when I stepped inside the Alamo 53 years ago. I have been back many times, but the feeling has never left me. Recently, I made some study of the history leading up to the battle. Why the 180-odd men who died in the Alamo were not reinforced and furnished with food, clothing, and ammunition by the settlers is not popularly known. I determined to write an article on this subject. Here it is. JFD. For more than 2 months in late 1835, a few hundred half-drilled Texas settlers had been camped outside San Antonio de Bear. It was the heart of the Spanish country of Texas, far west of the English-speaking colonies. The town and the old Alamo Mission Church, which had long been used as a fort, were held by General Martin Perfecto de Caz with about 1,400 Mexican soldiers and more than 20 cannon. The Texans, who since September had been in rebellion against the tyrannical rule of General Lopez de Santa Anna, had only one or two. Caz was brother-in-law to Santa Anna, the dictator of Mexico. There had been several skirmishes, in one of which Jim Bowie's men killed 67 Mexicans and lost only one man. Now was the time for a showdown. Who will go with old Ben Milam into San Antonio? 301 volunteers had answered the cry. At daybreak on the morning of December 5, 1835, they stormed the barricaded town. For 4 days and nights, they fought from house to house, battering down doors and walls. Milam himself was killed. On the morning of December 9th, all Mexicans not killed retreated inside the Alamo fortifications. Caz sent up a white flag. According to the terms of surrender, he and his forces retreated to the Rio Grande under promise not to return to Texas. Thus ended what is sometimes called the First Battle of the Alamo. In the opinion of most of the attackers, the war was over. At Goliad, 95 miles down the San Antonio River, the Mexican garrison had been liquidated. Now, not a single detachment of Santa Anna's troops was left in Texas. There had been no declaration of independence from Mexico either, only of opposition to the dictatorship of Santa Anna. Most of the settlers still acknowledged a kind of allegiance to the Mexico that had been governed under the liberal Constitution of 1824, modeled on the Constitution of the United States. Now, although Santa Anna was still opposed by some diehard Federalists, liberals, south of the Rio Grande, Mexico was under his totalitarian power. He had issued his plan to invade and subdue Texas. But after the victory over Caz, many Texans argued that Santa Anna had learned his lesson. Anyway, he was a long way off. The Texas fighting men were under oath to stay in the army. All during the weeks of delayed action at San Antonio, volunteers had been joining the army singly and in squads, and leaving singly and in squads. When a charge of command or plan of action dissatisfied them, they expressed their dissatisfaction by pulling out. No supply system furnished food, ammunition, or anything else. The men had to live on the country, and the living was thin. By January of 1836, the majority of the volunteers had gone home to warm clothes, plenty of cornbread and fried salt bacon, and to their families and farm work. Only a handful stayed to hold the San Antonio Fort. The Provisional Government of Texas, proclaimed in November of 1835, was divided from the beginning between the radical provisional governor, Henry Smith, and the conservative provisional council, each claiming executive power. The two had united in making Sam Houston major general and commander-in-chief of all the armed forces, but Houston's vigorous moves to organize and discipline an army were canceled by interference from the council. The fighting men furnished mostly their own arms. A few were enlisted as regulars. Most of them were volunteers. This provisional governor wanted complete separation from Mexico. The provisional council wanted to seize Matamoros on the Mexico side of the Rio Grande near its mouth, control imports there, and ally with Mexicans supposed to be resisting Santa Anna. The governor was backed by General Sam Houston, Colonel James Bowie, and less decisively by Colonel William Barrett Travis. Colonel James Fannin, a graduate of West Point, whose ambitions far exceeded his abilities, wanted to conquer Matamoros. He gained command of the main army with the council's support. The council deposed Governor Smith. The governor refused to be deposed. About the 1st of February, 1836, Houston, recognizing that he had in effect been supplanted by Fannin, took a leave of absence to make treaties with Indian tribes that Santa Anna's agents were trying to stir into a general uprising. Meanwhile, citizens in the settlements, utterly disgusted with the no government, showed a strange apathy. Not until March 1st would delegates elected by the municipalities meet at Washington on the Brazos to declare independence and formulate a permanent government. Stephen F. Austin, who had done more than all other colonizers combined to bring in settlers and make them prosperous and stable, did not have the qualities of a military leader. He had gone to the United States to raise money and men against despotism. The Texas officials were offering a section of land to every American who would join in their fight, in addition to pay and the right to homestead more land. By January of 1836, hundreds of land-hungry and adventure-hunting Americans were coming in. Most of those who reached San Antonio during the lull succeeding the surrender of Cause followed Colonel F.W. Johnson and Scott named James Grant off on the Matamoros goose chase. They never got within 100 miles of Matamoros. Meanwhile, a division of Santa Anna's army took over the port and prepared to march up the coast into Texas to attack the Johnson-Grant force, which now was commanded by Fannin. Many Mexicans at San Antonio were against Santa Anna. They knew better than anybody else that Santa Anna was coming with a strong army. In December, he proclaimed that all foreigners, volunteers from the United States and elsewhere, operating in Texas, would be treated as pirates and that every colonist resisting him would lose his property, to say nothing of life. By the end of the year, he had collected between 6,000 and 8,000 troops below the border. At the opening of the new year, 1836, Lieutenant Colonel J.C. Neal commanded about 100 men in San Antonio. Leaders of the proposed Matamoros expedition had taken virtually all the medical supplies on hand, blankets, and any clothing not on the bodies of the remaining soldiers. On January 16th, Neal reported that his men were almost naked, not having more than one shirt and one blanket apiece, that in 4 months they had received not 1 cent of pay, that he was short on good powder, but had plenty of small arms, cannon, and lead, captured from Cause. 3,000 Mexican soldiers had already assembled at Laredo on the Rio Grande, he said, probably an overestimate. 20 of his men were going to leave on the morrow. But, declared Neal, if I have only 100 men, I will fight 1,000 as long as I can and then not surrender. San Antonio had fallen into the hands of Texas volunteers early in December 1835. Everyone knew that General Santa Anna was coming someday with a powerful army, but that day seemed far away as he was down in Mexico. The volunteers without pay or supplies of any kind can hardly be blamed for tiring of waiting and pulling out. While the garrison holding the Alamo was at its lowest ebb, Bowie arrived on January 19, 1836, with 30 men. It will be remembered that Bowie had taken part in the battle that drove Mexican forces from San Antonio. He had gone back east to the settlements. Now he brought orders from General Sam Houston to blow up the Alamo, demolish all other fortifications, and take all ordnance and ordnance supplies for stands at Gonzales and Copano, the nearest port on the coast. Neal had already reported that teams could not be obtained for moving the cannon. His men had a good many horses, but had to keep them under herd on grass miles away from town. On February 2nd, Bowie reported to the provisional governor, "The salvation of Texas depends in great measure in keeping Bear, San Antonio, out of the hands of the enemy. It serves as the frontier picket guard, and if it were in the possession of Santa Anna, there is no stronghold from which to repel him in his march toward the Sabine. Colonel Neal and myself have come to the solemn resolution that we would rather die in these ditches than give them up to the enemy. The return this day to the commandant shows only 120 officers and men." The very next day, February 3rd, Travis came in with 25 men. His commission was as lieutenant colonel of the cavalry in the regular army. His men were mostly regulars. On February 8th, David Crockett arrived with 16 Tennessee boys. He told some anecdotes to the assembled welcomers and declared that he and his men were there to fight. He bore the rank of private, but his followers had elected him their colonel. 3 days later, Neal, called home by family sickness, turned over his command to Travis and left the Alamo. Bowie considered that he outranked Travis. At 40, he did not propose subordination to a 27-year-old novice. He was far older in experiences of fighting and leadership, as well as in years. The whole story of the Alamo is of men willing to die, but not to obey. On February 24th, an illness, perhaps typhoid fever, perhaps pneumonia, perhaps something else, that had been coming up on him for days, put Bowie flat on a cot and left Travis in undisputed command. What manner of men were these waiting to die in defense of the key to Texas? The oldest was a Virginian named Robert Moore. He was 55, against Crockett's 50. The youngest may have been Carlos Espialier, 17, attached to Bowie. He and six or eight other Mexicans were the only native-born Texans present. In the ranks were at least 14 natives of England, and about that many were from Scotland, Ireland, Wales, Germany, and Denmark combined. The great majority of the men had come to Texas from southern states, but New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and other northern states were represented. Captain Almarin Dickerson, 26, from Tennessee, commanded the artillery. He was the only soldier whose wife followed him into the Alamo. She became the chief messenger of defeat. Their infant daughter has come down in history as the babe of the Alamo. Travis, school teacher and lawyer from South Carolina, had been practicing law in Texas for 5 years. 6 feet tall and raw-boned, he had pulled ahead of most of the settlers in advocating a war of independence. He had reserve powers. Houston rated Bowie ahead of all other Texas officers in forecast, prudence, and valor. Always riding, seeking, daring, not always prudent, he had been a man of affairs since 18. He stood an inch over 6 feet tall, all muscle and bone, spoke in both French and Spanish, magnetized men and women alike. Travis's best friend was Lieutenant James Butler Bonham, another military-minded lawyer. The two had been boyhood comrades in South Carolina. Crockett's part in the Alamo was subordinate also, but his name was already well known before he arrived. A few years back, he had killed 105 bears in one season, and got elected to the Tennessee legislature on his reputation. Then Davy went to Congress, where he was of little consequence, but took a smart-aleck stand against President Jackson. Federalist, Republican, politicians advertised him as a man of the Jacksonian soil of their side. Defeated for re-election, Crockett told voters that they could go to hell and he would go to Texas. Dying in the Alamo was his passport to fame. Of the 40,000 or so visitors who now enter the Alamo monthly, few beyond specializing historians have a conception of the fortifications that Green Jameson's drawings of 1836 make clear. The Alamo Church, with side rooms, was begun in 1744 and completed in 1757. Only 5 years later, its two towers fell down and its convex roof caved in. It was not until 1848 that the U.S. Army re-roofed the chapel and put up its present facade. In 1805, the walled-in patios and buildings attached to the church were occupied by Spanish troops, and thenceforth they were not used by military forces until the climactic battle. The Alamo Church faces west, toward the old town of Bear. The north church wall formed part of the small courtyard. The tumbled remains of a strongly built convent form the west wall of this courtyard. Walls 12 feet high enclosed the two other sides. The old convent rooms composed what was known as the Long Barracks. They were two stories high. At one corner was a kind of a tower. To the west of church and barracks and projecting north and south of them, a rectangular courtyard covering nearly 2 acres was surrounded by strong walls against which other barracks backed. The main battle of the Alamo was in defense of the outer walls. After the Mexicans scaled them, the fiercest fighting was in the long barracks. The final stand of the defenders was in the chapel, the roofless walls of which stood 22 feet high and 4 thick. The debris of the fallen roof had been mounded up to serve as a platform for 3 12-pounder cannon. From 15 to 18 other cannon were mounted at strategic positions along the outer walls. The flag did not float from the church, but from kind of a tower room at the southwest corner of the long barracks. Until Santa Anna's troops arrived, soldiers off duty spent a part of their time in town. There were cantinas, saloons, but money was so scarce that some men traded their rifles for firewater. Joe Hawkins wrote the lieutenant governor a letter interlarded with allusions to Cataline and Argus and including, "This morning after applying at headquarters, I could not raise a bit, 12 and a half cents, to pay for washing a shirt and must go with a dirty one." Men often took long rides prospecting for land they intended to settle on. Rainfall was better adapted to farming farther east, but 1836 happened to be a rainy year, and the farming country was far away. On the way to Texas, Crockett had already picked out his estate. Good land, plenty of timber, clear water springs, game aplenty, bees and honey aplenty. Everybody knew that Santa Anna was coming, but reports of his coming had been arriving for such a long time that every morning everybody considered that it would be another day, maybe weeks, before he arrived. Along in February, Mexican families were leaving town for the country. It was not the season for Comanche raids and threats that kept Mexican settlers huddled together most of the year. On February 22nd, Americans saw carts carrying Mexican goods and families out of town in all directions. Travis was very uneasy. He kept a lookout in the tower of the San Fernando Church. On the morning of February 23rd, the lookout rang the bell violently. He said that he had seen cavalrymen to the west, the sun glinting on their spears, and that when he rang, they disappeared into the brush. He could not show anybody what he said he had seen and was discredited by men who did not want to believe facts. Dr. John Sutherland and John W. Smith, who had horses in a corral attached to the barracks, got permission from Travis to ride out on a scout. When they reached the crest of a hill, about a mile and a half from the church, they beheld, on prairie land, beyond 1,200 or 1,500 cavalrymen, according to their estimate, forming in line of battle, their commander riding up and down in front of them, waving his sword. They wheeled their horses and broke in a run for town. The sentry in the bell tower understood and began ringing furiously. While all was movement within fortification, Crockett stepped up to Travis and said, "Colonel, assign me to some place, and I and my Tennessee boys will hold it." Travis assigned him a picket stockade running from the southwest corner of the old church to the rock wall. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, Santa Anna was flying a red flag from the main plaza and had some of his batteries planted. Contrary to common belief, the Texans did not fly a Lone Star, but a tricolored, red, white, and green, Mexican flag with 1824 stitched across the white stripe. At the sight of the red flag, Travis ordered a discharge of artillery toward it, out of range. About the same time, Bowie received a report that the Mexicans had sounded a parley. He sent out a note by a messenger bearing a white flag to inquire if a parley was desired. The answer, signed by Santa Anna's aide-de-camp, was that the only recourse for rebellious foreigners wishing to save their lives was to surrender unconditionally. This was probably Bowie's last official act. The next day, he was helpless. As soon as Travis could get his men together behind the walls of the Alamo, after the arrival of Santa Anna's forces, he made them a no-surrender oration. He sent Dr. John Sutherland and John V. Smith to Gonzales to plead for men and provisions. "We have 150 men, the hasty note reads, "and are determined to defend the Alamo to the last." That night and the next, Texans demolished jacales, cabins, within reach along the Asequinas, irrigation ditches, and dragged in wood for fuel. They had been dependent upon an Asequina for water. On February 24th, Travis sent out the most heroic message in the annals of North American war. One imagines that he spent hours of the cannon-shaken night composing it. It was not addressed to the feudal political authorities who had so often been besought, but to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world, fellow citizens and compatriots, I am besieged with 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Anna. I have sustained a continual bombardment and cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword if the fort is taken. I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. Then I call upon you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character, to come to our aid with all dispatch. The enemy is receiving reinforcements daily and will no doubt increase to 3,000 or 4,000 in 4 or 5 days. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due his own honor and that of his country. Victory or death. Travis's main hope was in Fannin, stalled in his Matamoras hallucination in Goliad, where he occupied a walled-in mission. It stood on the San Antonio River, about 95 miles southeast of the Alamo. He had been receiving American volunteers and some supplies through Capano, a small port no longer extant. Even if they got inside, they were doomed. Bonham rode on alone. He had a white handkerchief tied as a band around his hat, a sign of recognition that had been agreed upon by him and Travis. The gate was open as he dashed up, on a cream-white horse, all in a foam. The hour was 11 o'clock in the morning. The Mexican seemed willing to let in anybody who wanted to enter the trap. 2 days before, on the night of March 1st, 32 Texas citizens from Gonzales had been piloted into the fort by John W. Smith, the messenger who went out with Dr. Sutherland the day Santa Anna arrived. Smith went back to Gonzales for more men. When he returned a second time, Dr. Sutherland and the small company with him saw an advance guard of Santa Anna soldiers moving toward them, heard no cannon, and knew the Alamo had fallen. The 32 Gonzales men were the only enforcements received by Travis. They gave him a total of 180-odd men. Only the cries of their famished children and the smoke of their burning buildings will arouse the settlers, Travis wrote. About the same time, now in futile desperation, Fannin wrote, "I have but 3 Texas citizens in the ranks, and though I have called on them for 6 weeks, not one arrived. If I am lost, be the censure on the right head, and may my wife and children and children's children curse the sluggards forever." The main settlements of Texas on the Colorado and the Brazos and further east were a long, long way off, and it was increasingly evident that no help could be expected from them. Nightly, the beleaguerers improved their positions around the barricades and daily received reinforcements. The Mexican marches across waterless lands on both sides of the Rio Grande were slow and tortured. At intervals, when they were free from manning the walls and guns, the Texans mounded up dirt against their walls to counteract the effect of cannonballs. In darkness, they sailed out to destroy horses used by Mexican riflemen. Mexican rifle fire was absolutely ineffectual, and it would seem that no Texans were killed by the cannoning. Yet it was almost continuous, keeping the defenders at their positions and preventing sleep. There were not enough defenders to afford any relief from duty. The 2 acres of fortified ground would have required about 1,000 men for rotation of manpower. The only sleep the Texans got was in snatches at the positions designated for every man. Their only food was meat, mostly jerked, and bread of corn, sometimes only parched corn. They had no coffee, tea, or sugar, and it was doubtful if a sip of any kind of liquor was left. Night alarms were frequent. The defenders had to reserve firing on account of the shortage of powder. One day a cannonball they discharged all but demolished the house occupied by Santa Anna. Occasionally, a Mexican received a rifle hit. A side room to the Alamo Chapel held a supply of powder left by cause. It was ineffective in cannon, much less in rifles. According to the general agreement, the last Texan left alive would, after the Mexicans poured in, fire the magazine and blow some more of them to hell. On March 4th, unknown to the Texans, Santa Anna called a council of war to consider assault on the Alamo. General Cause, who had returned to Texas in violation of the terms of his surrender at San Antonio, General Castrillon, and others advised awaiting the arrival of 2 12-pounders expected on the 7th before making an assault. Santa Anna already had more than 5,000 men at San Antonio. He dismissed the council without announcing a decision. An unusually heavy bombardment was kept up all day. By 2 o'clock on March 5th, a Saturday, Santa Anna had issued confidential orders to his subordinates to begin the assault at 4 o'clock the next morning. It was to be made by 4 columns, one to each side of the quadrangle, each supplied with axes, crowbars, and scaling ladders. The cavalry was to be stationed in the rear around the fortress to prevent desertion of their own troops and escape of any Texan. About 10 o'clock at night of March 5th, all firing ceased. Travis and other men seemed to have realized that this was the lull before the storm. The Texans worked until midnight, strengthening their positions. 3 pickets were placed outside the walls to raise the alarm in case of attack. A single sentry stood or walked somewhere within the fortifications. For 12 days and nights, there had been almost no surcease to besieger bombardment and to defender vigilance. Now, in the quietness, the men fell asleep beside rifles and cannon. Whether the first charge was made at 4 or 5 o'clock is debatable. It was announced by a single bugle blast and then by shouts of rushing Mexicans. The Mexican artillery could no longer fire without danger to its own men. "Come on, boys, the Mexicans are upon us," Travis yelled as he ran across the courtyard to a cannon at the northeast corner. There was evidently enough light from the sky to enable the Texan cannons to rake the assaulting columns. The Mexicans fell by the hundreds. They reeled back twice before making a third rush that carried them to the walls. Here, the cannon could not be depressed sufficiently to reach them. But rifle fire on them, as they scaled the ladders, was deadly. Many fell from blows on the head, knocking down men beneath them. According to one reliable account, out of 830 men in the Tulica Battalion, only 130 were left alive. With sabers and pistols, reserves behind the attackers forced them on. Meanwhile, Mexican buglers were blasting out the dreadful notes of El Degollo, the call of fire and death that had come down from Moorish wars in Spain. Degollo, meaning literally throat cutting. Within half an hour from the time of the first assault, Mexicans were pouring over the walls, pouring over like sheep, Travis's slave boy Joe, who had survived, said. In the hand-to-hand fighting, the Texans, unable to reload rifles and pistols, used them as clubs. They cut with knives and swords, grappled barehanded. Travis was shot through the head beside his cannon. Bonham fell at another cannon. Crockett was still defending the picket stockade when he fell. Bowie died on his cot after he had emptied his pistols into invaders of his room. Some claim in a paroxysm of fury, he arose from the cot and killed with his knife. The last retreat was into the chapel. Here, Major Robert Evans had seized a torch to pitch into the powder magazine when he was shot down. According to one Mexican account, 5 empty-handed Texans tried to surrender and were slaughtered. It is impossible to be absolute on the number of either Texans or Mexicans killed. There could hardly have been a dozen more than the 187 Texans listed by Amelia Williams, the final scholar on Alamo history. In his official report, Santa Anna said that he lost 70 men and killed 600 Texans. His private secretary said that the Mexican dead amounted to 1,544. A Mexican sergeant reported around 2,000. Other reports ranged between 521 and 1,200. Around 1,500 seems like a credible figure. After the last Texan was killed, Santa Anna asked to be shown the bodies of Travis and Bowie. There, he ordered his cavalry to drag in mesquite wood for burning the bodies of all Texans. The wood and the dead were piled up layer by layer, and fire started. The dead Mexicans were ostensibly given Christian burial, but the trenches dug in the graveyard were not long or wide or deep enough to hold all the bodies, and many were pitched into the San Antonio River. Thermoplay and her passenger of defeat. The Alamo had none. None but a woman and a slave who escaped to freedom the next year. On March 2nd, the long-awaited Declaration of Texas Independence had been issued at Washington on the Brazos by men elected to form a new government. With full executive powers, General Houston was forming an army to fight Santa Anna even before he heard the fall of the Alamo. 2 Sundays following the fall, Fannin surrendered to one of Santa Anna's divisions all his men who had not been cut off and cut down. A week later, on Palm Sunday, March 27th, the unarmed prisoners were marched out, formed in lines, and shot down by their guards. This was the Goliad Massacre. Now the inhabitants of Texas were abandoning their homes everywhere and fleeing east in what is called the Runaway Scrape. Santa Anna was extending his lines. Houston was shortening his. On April 21st, at San Jacinto on Buffalo Bayou, near what is now the city of Houston, the Texans charged the Mexicans, yelling, "Remember the Alamo! Remember Goliad. Their fury was unbounded. With few losses, they annihilated Santa Anna's army. Many a Mexican trying to surrender called out, "Me no Alamo, me no Goliad." Remember the Alamo. That cry, like the shot fired at Concord, has been heard around the world. San Jacinto effected an independent republic. The Alamo made a drama of life and death immortal. Also, it made Santa Anna's forces remarkably less formidable, softening them up for Houston's dramatic victory at San Jacinto. True West Magazine, June 1959 edition. She was a crusty old soul, but you admired her no matter how else you felt. I Knew Jesse James's Mother, by Homer Croy. Editor's note: April 13, 1959 marked the 77th anniversary of the death of Jesse James, notorious bank robber of the Old West, shot down by Robert Ford, a member of his own band. James soon became a legendary figure. Today, the legend is growing, and the facts sometimes are obscured. Here for the first time, author Homer Croy, who wrote Jesse James Was My Neighbor and Last of the Great Outlaws, offers facts about the woman behind James, his mother. What an amazing woman Jesse James's mother was. I used to go to her house, and there she was, 6 feet tall, people said. She had only one arm. That added immeasurably to the wonder and mystery of her as I knew her as a boy. Her right arm had been blown off by sneaking Pinkerton detectives. That's what we called them. In some strange way, she was sensitive about her arm and used to stand with it turned away so people could not see the stump. She had courage. When the detectives crept up and threw the black powder bomb into her house, she darted out the door, and there they were. 10 detectives squatting in the yard this January morning at dawn. She shook what was left of her arm at them and defied them with words you won't find in your Sunday school lessons. She started back into the house and stumbled over the body of her son, Archie, killed by the detectives. He was 9 years old. The amazing woman went back into the yard and once more defied the detectives, again waving that stump. That strange, fiery woman had qualities that we have to admire. I think she was about the first college graduate I ever saw, except some of my teachers. She had gone to a Roman Catholic convent in Lexington, Kentucky. Her graduation diploma hangs on the wall of her old home today, and there you can see it if you amble by. Her name was Zerelda E. Cole. There was a young fellow named Robert James going to Georgetown College in Georgetown, Kentucky. He met the saucy young college girl. You know what happened. But getting married wasn't quite the matter it might seem. She was 16 and an orphan, so she had a guardian who looked the young, would-be preacher over and said, "You may not be able to support her. You've got to up a bond of 50 pounds of tobacco before I'll let you marry her." The boy dusted around and got the tobacco, so she was called the Tobacco Bride. The guardian was her uncle, Jesse Cole. When a blue-eyed baby came along, she named him Jesse for her uncle. That's how the Jesse name got in. The family was living in Missouri, and Jesse's father was preaching right and left. He helped start a college which is going today, William Jewell College. There's a charter hanging on the wall, and there's Jesse's dad's name as big as life. Seems odd, doesn't it, that Jesse's father would help start a religious college? And there you have it. Jesse's father, a preacher. His mother, a college graduate. Aunt Zarel had an almost square face, high cheekbones, blue eyes, and a temper that would fry an egg. And that's exactly what Jesse had. She was in a Yankee neighborhood and kept shouting for the South. One day, some Union soldiers rode up to the house and asked for Jesse, who was then 15. He was in the field plowing. The men went out where he was and beat him with a rope till the blood ran down his back. His mother came running, flew into the soldiers, and gave them a tongue lashing that shook the daisies. She was so mad, so bitter, this mother fighting for her son, that the soldiers threw her in jail for 2 weeks. Jesse was never in jail a day of his life. What a contrast. She began to fight for her children. They were misunderstood. She was like a character out of the Bible, this strange woman fighting for her errant sons. She wanted Jesse to be a preacher, like his father. And Jess, she always called him Jess, was minded that way. He liked to sing hymns. Once, for a short time, in Callaway County, he taught singing school. He carried a tuning fork in his pocket. He'd sound it, and the singers would raise the roof. At the close of the Civil War, Jesse was on the way to a schoolhouse to surrender when some Union soldiers saw him and shot him through the lungs. This shows how deep the bitterness between the North and South was at this time in our section. He was nursed back to health by a cousin, whom he later married. Aunt Zarel said that her two sons, Jess and Buck, as she called Frank, were victims of the Civil War, and that is, I think, true. They came from the hottest corner in that useless war between the North and South, Clay County, Missouri. There came into her life a great and almost overwhelming disappointment. Jesse turned bank robber. But that did not make her stop defending him. He wouldn't have been a bank robber, she said, if he hadn't been starving and the banks rolling in money. At this time, the banks were unregulated and could charge a farmer any old amount of interest they wanted. When he began to rob railroads, she had an excuse for that, too. The railroads were unregulated, she said, and could charge a farmer any amount they wanted to for shipping his livestock. And that was just about true. Our people didn't try too hard to catch Jesse. When Jesse and his men robbed a bank, my father and the neighbors would get out their foaling pieces, hop on the fat farm horses, and pursue Jesse. They knew that the Jesse James gang had the best horses obtainable and that the men were dead shots. So Pa and the neighbors loped gently along, hoping they wouldn't see the gang. It wasn't long until there was a reward of $10,000 on Jesse's head, dead or alive, preferably the former. His mother was astounded. Then came the day when Jesse was killed by a snake who had been living in Jesse's home for 2 weeks, just waiting for the chance. The mother was sent for. When she saw the body, she wept copiously, saying, "This is my son. Oh, Jesse, they have taken you from me." She sobbed so deeply she had to be escorted from the room. He was buried in front of her house. Before the casket was lowered, she put her head on it and sobbed, "Oh, my darling, misunderstood son." 20 years and 2 months, the body was in her front yard. She used to sit in a rocking chair on the porch and look at the grave and say, "My poor boy, they never understood him." Once, when I was in her yard, she looked at me with her fading eyes and said, "I can see you are young. I hope you are as fine a boy as mine were." She grew more and more feeble. Meanwhile, Frank bought a farm near Fletcher, Oklahoma. The old lady went down to see him and stayed a week. Time came for her to leave. She was put on a sleeper and started home. In the middle of the night, she called the porter. "There's something wrong," she said. She died on the train in February 1911. She was 87. When the train crew found out who she was, they were astonished. Her request was that she was to be buried beside Jesse in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Kearney, Missouri. "I want to lie down beside him," she said. She left the words she wanted cut into his tombstone. The date of Jesse's birth and death are set down. Then this: "In loving remembrance of my beloved son, Jesse James, murdered by a traitor and coward whose name is not worthy to appear here." And there, that tombstone stands today, chipped down a lot by tourists so that only the pedestal is left. And that is the story of the Tobacco Bride, who loved her wayward sons so devotedly. Reprinted by permission, Parade Publications Incorporated, 286 Madison Avenue, New York 17, New York.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.